It's in that friction. It's the friction in between, I think, is the source for hopefully curiosity, but also imagination.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Garrick Jones. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today I'm here with one of my co-authors, Simon Brown. We're talking to Johan Roos. We're very curious to hear your story. Delighted you're with us, of course. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Of course. I've worked in several business schools in several countries and so forth. And I've done some other things as well. But I think the most interesting question would be, what do I do? What I do is that I like to see myself to drive innovation and quality in higher education, especially business school. But I also have an interest in innovating business practices as well. So in short, that's what I do.
Amazing. And we have so many topics that we want to cover, which sort of all encompass these things that you do. I mean, topics like curiosity and education. Really interested to hear more about LEGO Serious Play and where it is today. That links to construction and constructivism, which are connected to our 7 C's model, that we talk about the 7 C's of curiosity. And then, you know, you've really touched on imagination and innovation, but also I know that you have an interest in improvisation. Where should we start? What's your view on curiosity and education, Johan?
Isn't curiosity what education should be about and feeding to some extent, well, to a large extent? And in an ideal world, of course, we think of young people coming into education as sort of a little bit of a blank piece of paper, and then we fill it. That's the classical view of education. But I think in higher education, we have to think about how do we get bright people of various ages to develop in ways that make sense to them and to our society. So curiosity, I think, is a driving force for this. As I would say, imagination is as well. I always seen those two together, in a sense that curiosity is sort of the engine and imagination is sort of a response to that. So we could, of course, argue back and forth about whether education is up for it and whether education is at the forefront of this or not. But that's sort of a different debate, but happy to elaborate on that.
Which might have to be one we'll dig into in a moment. I'm interested how much you see education needing to incite or inspire curiosity within the students. So one approach is you know, someone comes in, spends however many years in education, we open up their brain, we pour in a whole load of facts, and out they come and can recite those facts very well. Another approach would be making them curious and, you know, equipping them with the expertise to ask the right questions and go on a voyage of discovery from thereafter. I'm curious as to how you see educational institutes, Holt International as one, but maybe also in general, in terms of how much people really do inspire curiosity within those students?
Well, it's a very broad, sweeping question. And I don't want to make myself as a spokesperson for every educational institution in the world. But I do think, let me just give you an example of how I think about it. And that is, we've recently, in my own institution, renewed, I'd say, quite significantly, an undergraduate curricula for, it's actually a bachelor in business administration, which we run in both Boston and London. And these are for kids that are, you know, anything from 18 to 20, 21, whatever. And they come in. And when we changed this curricula, we had a couple of things at the forefront. And one was, let's do more of skills development in addition to knowledge development. So let's teach skills in addition to knowledge. That is quite of a dramatic shift, actually, for all parties. But and then you can say, what kind of skill? Well, some basic, we can get back to that, some basic business skills, some technical skills, but absolutely more fundamentally, basic human skills.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. But that is to kind of stimulate the curiosity in various ways of being, you know, a good, capable human being who knows some stuff, but also know how to do stuff. But as part of that, I insisted on a dimension of this, which is about learning to learn.
Mm.
So that is integrated in all the modules. And it's really, you know, we can think of it in very superficial ways. For instance, debriefing after something and you learn, what did I do? What went right? What went well? What should we should continue to do? And what didn't go so well that we should change? But if you think of it, learning to learn can be really deep. And I think very much at the heart of what education should be about. It's this notion of, it's almost like deeper than tutorial. Tutorial becomes a method and teaching becomes a method for this. But learning to learn is really about learning how to grow yourself and how to take charge of your own life and your own educational journey, so to say. So there are various ways to do that. But that is an important part of our curricula. And I think that's very good. And it's, what should we call it, catalyzing innovation. It's with a friendly, not being invisible, but with a friendly hand, making this, stimulating the curiosity a little bit, stimulating perhaps some of your seven C's, but catalyzing it, I'd say, with a bit of guidance. And we put in life coaches almost into the program as well and integrate. So that is all to help these younger people learning to learn, learning to know themselves, and learning to actually create value as well.
I love the idea of learning to learn. It's a bit like teaching people coding, almost. You're giving them coding skills, which they then can apply in very many different ways. It's constructivist. It's much more, you're getting the tools that you can use to learn for yourselves on an ongoing basis. Building on that, I'm interested in your views. You know, you talked about the new Bachelor of Business Administration, and I know you do the postgraduate work. What do you think about the shift in the curriculum? If learning to learn and these kind of life skills are important, what are your views on the changes that we need to implement with regard to new skills required in the digital age in particular? You know, everything's changed because of digital and online, and we have so many opportunities. What do you think we should be teaching to take the best opportunity of these things?
Well, you can say there is a time scale. Well, actually, it's like a milk package. It's like, you know, best before you consume best. There's a, what do you call it? Best before date.
Yeah.
And I always thought of education as a best before date. You see, to some extent, it's very old fashioned. We issue sort of a degree or a certificate and we put it on the wall. I have a few on my walls. But like that was a long time ago. What did you do after? It's like, so if we think of education as a constant process, a flow, it's almost like a personal developmental journey, a personal process of inputting and taking things and learning how to learn, learning something and learning how to learn. It becomes sort of a journey of discovery. And then you can say, what skills should we teach? Well, at the shortest best before date, we could teach them some, let's say, some programming language, mm-hmm. right? We teach them Python. Right? Mm. But who knows? I'm as old, so I started to learn basics and then a little bit of Fortran, Pascal. These are like...
me too.
after the Second World War. Sometimes, right? But like, they changed. And, you know, there was C, C++, C++. All of this changed very quickly in a sense. So you can... of course, teach them an immediate skills and say, that's very useful. But do you need to go to university to do that? Well, perhaps, or can you just take a course of that or somebody else teach you or the company teach? But then you can go back into and say, well, what about the skill like marketing or budgeting, right? Then it suddenly becomes more complicated, even more complicated than selling and accounting. Right. Mm. So there's you can make it infinitely more complex. And then it's like, well, that has a longer time scale. If you learn accounting, well, it should be reasonably stable, that will last. But you need to understand that budgeting is not accounting. It's a much more complicated, almost political process of maneuvering in an organization to develop a budget, getting it approved and so forth. So that requires more human skills as well. And then they should last a little bit longer. And then you can go even deeper, further and say, well, what about the whole idea of critical thinking, creative thinking, collaboration, communication, all of these C skills that we usually, some people call them soft skills, I love to call them basic skills or human skills. Well, they last a long time, right? They last a long time. And then if you add sort of a cultural context to this, they, and learn that as well, wow, then you know how to communicate and interact in a, not just in a, let's say, a British system or a British culture, but you learn to do it in a French or a multinational or in even a global culture where you learn that there's certain taboos you shouldn't do and you shouldn't say this or you should do this. Then you have much more longer lasting skills. So I always think of it as like a best before, and we should really focus on the latter part here. I think that's where we have the capabilities in higher education to help them. And then we can spice it up with some shorter lasting technical skills as well.
Johan Roos is the Chief Academic Officer at Hull International Business School. He's known for his work on intellectual capital and most famously on LEGO Serious Play. He has extensive writing on strategy, processes and innovation.
Fully agree with that. And we talk about that a bit in the book, in fact, around how I think back in 2019, the data was saying about 19% of the skills that we have then would be expiring within 3 years. And fast forward a couple of years, that's now 26%. So a quarter of the skills that we have expiring in 3 years. And counter to that, 46% of people, nearly half of us, have learned a new-to-world skill in the last 3 years. So we've got new skills coming, old skills going, and completely agree with what you said, that it's the technical ones that are getting faster and faster and faster, which actually means if we're choosing on where do we invest our time in a skill, well, technical skills are important and will serve us for a period of time. It's actually the power skills, the soft skills, those are the things that will be more enduring. And therefore, if I'm investing my time in having those skills, you know, that actually might last me for 20 years if I'm learning critical thinking, as you say, and that will carry me through. And I think all of that seems to have been supercharged by some of the developments in the last months with things like AI, generative AI, ChatGPT, some of these pieces. Where do you see, I guess, almost education going in light of some of these latest developments of where AI is going, where maybe we don't, I'll say a controversial statement, you know, maybe we don't need to know certain things in the future. Maybe we'll be guided by an AI, and recognize that's taking it to the extreme on where we are today. But actually, maybe in 10 years' time, with AI doubling every 6 months, interesting to think.
It's super interesting. I think we're at the calculator moment, you know, like when the calculator was introduced into schools, and we had
the shock horror.
I remember it as well.
We were allowed to bring a calculator into the maths class.
Yeah. Like, oh, are you cheating now or what? But it's the same kind of moment, I think, now. But if we just step back and say, there has been some dramatic developments over the last couple of years, and then we can go over the last 2 months. Mm. And the last couple of years, and with COVID accelerating it, it's the whole online, of course, you know, we just have to go online immediately, and then there was hybrid, and then there's online, and I think that has had tremendous positive effects, a shock in the system, because it provides, suddenly we have more flexibility, you know, the whole supply of online based education is an equalizer, it's a spreader, it's a radical booster of supply. So that is, I still think we're trying to figure out what will happen, what is the consequences of that. Universities are still around, right? You know, the bricks and mortars are still standing there. But most universities today are offering some online work and online courses or online programs. And I think this will be, it's a must. It's just a matter of how do you do it. You do everything yourself, or you work with partners, or you, you know, some of the other providers. We have decided to bring in one of the other providers and enrich our content that our professors are doing with content provided by others. So I tell all the professors, I ask them, why should anyone listen to you? and sort of it is a provocative question to say that, well, you may have great content, but there's great content out there. So go out and get it. And we have helped by opened up the doors to some fantastic suppliers. So I see this sort of the professorial role becoming much more of a going down from the sage on the stage to the curator of almost like free, fantastic content from anywhere in the world. But then you have to be an expert. A novice cannot put together great stuff. Experts can do. It's like, don't trust the spontaneity of a novice, trust the spontaneity of experts. It's the whole idea that there is something there, but the job has changed and online is helping. So that I think is a broad sweeping, I think a radical, but ultimately positive development on based on online. So do you want me to comment on the last couple of months as
Yeah, the last couple of months would be interesting, the latest AI developments, absolutely.
And you know, I'm sort of a reader of good science fiction.
Who's your favorite? I have to ask. Who's your
Arthur favorite? C. Clarke and Philip K. Dick, of course, like, you know, the best of the best. But the whole idea of science fiction authors have for a long time speculated about what happens with the rise of AI. It's a, you know, pop culture has taken it into Terminator and Matrix and all that. But if you great science fiction authors typically, they look at the world and say, what if I took one variable and changed it? How would the world look like? And I think that's a brilliant sort of approach to life. Use your imagination on. But that's just setting it up a little bit. So we have, of course, seen plenty of people who've thought about what if you can talk to your computer and what if the computer start to know more about you. And I think it's good to not to be too, you know, you have to sit still in your seat a little bit on these things because things are happening very quickly here. But as of today, we talk about AI as like very narrow AI, right? Narrow AI. That means that AI can do certain things. It can solve very specifically defined problems based on algorithms, all right? So we set up an algorithm and go do it. You can do the machine can do it very, very fast. What has happened over the last couple of years is that the whole notion of machine learning has been accelerated. The whole idea that we can now, not like you and me, and if we were to do a diagram and we have a couple of bullets and we say these variables should influence these variables and there's an outcome, like a simple bubble diagram. Now that we can do conceptually, because we're humans, we can figure out two or three layers of impact, right? But the huge development, I think, is twofold here. One is on neural networks, and deep neural networks. The other one is on generative AI, particularly large language models. Mm. And the deep neural networks, I think, are so ultimately fascinating that you can set up millions of variables in millions of layers. From like there's cause and then there's some kind of layers of stuff and then there's some effect. And nobody really knows what it is because there are zillions of possibility of combinations. And that whole idea that you can actually get such models and train them on factual stuff, like looking for cancer in images or whatever, and then let it loose on new data and it will be very accurate in its prediction. I think that's fascinating, but it's still narrow AI, right? That I think is good. But the other development, which still is narrow AI, and we must not forget this, it is this generative AI and the large language models, which are pre-trained in some particular way. And these language models have, of course, existed before. Google has had one, Google has gotten one, that is OpenAI had the GPT-2 last year, right? Mm-hmm. GPT-3 came up. And then it's been pre-trained and focused on chat, right? So hence ChatGPT. Mm-hmm. And I think the big bang on this one is that it's so damn good.
Yes.
that it's the wow effect that they managed to break down language into what is called tokens, which are not words, but parts of words and all that. And being able to, with Bayesian probability statistics, nothing magic here, just figure this one out on this billion parameter, billion data points level.
It's just we have so much computing power now that we can actually do it with the old tools.
So when you and I ask a question, we tell ChatGPT to be an expert in this and this, and then we ask the question. And we get something back that looks like, my God, it's responding. That is the wow effect. And I think that's where OpenAI is to be congratulated, that they were the first and quickest out with that type of algorithm. You look at the others and it's like a little bit embarrassing for them, you know, that the prompt is good. And some of the Chinese competitors are are trying, like, what on earth can we do? We have your data, but they have surveillance data and WeChat data. So they don't have these million English language articles and stuff that is being fed into the OpenAI system. So I think that is great, and it's fantastic, and it's changing a lot, but it's still narrow AI, just so we don't forget about it. But when narrow AI eventually will move into generalized AI, which is what we have,
yes,
there's going to be a change. And then it will move into super AI. And then we don't know what's happened, because we are mere meek humans who understand an Intel IQ of 100 and 150 and God knows 170. But what an IQ of 12,000 or 15,000 or 25,000.
And that's a whole new ballgame.
That's, you know, then we are the ants and somebody's looking at us. So there's something, but that's like a little bit science fiction right now. But I think the tools are really good now. And this is creating shock and awe, not the least in the educational system, because it's a calculator moment. Is this cheating? Or should you be using this as a calculator to improve stuff? Mm. And of course, I'm totally for the second part.
Yeah.
So we set up very early in Hull, for instance, the task force on this very early on, and just say, what are the short-term implications? How do we encourage this? What are the changes in rigid academic policies that needs to be done to encompass and welcome this development? So our faculty are now straight into it, experimenting, doing fantastic stuff. That's how it should be.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
That's fascinating. I love the fact that you say we should be open to it and we should find out what it can do for us. I mean, I remember the same thing, bringing laptops, allowing students to bring laptops. You know, talk about a calculator. Then bringing laptops into the... When I'd be teaching, you suddenly discover that they're fact-checking you or they're finding information that relates to everything you talk about, which changes the entire student dynamic, and it changes what we as you say, as you can't be the sage on the stage anymore. You have to be a curator, and you have to curate their experience and open them up to all the... I love the idea that we can open it up. The amount of computing power that we have these days really brings... In the last 2 months, I've kind of realized this dream of, you know, learning in the flow of work and being able to have information that is contextually relevant right at the point that we need it. Well, we're starting to see that becoming a powerful reality. The other thing I really loved about what you're talking about, science fiction, I love science fiction myself. I read Ursula Le Guin's book, The Left Hand of Darkness, again, where she has a radical idea of putting us with an alien force, an alien group who are completely different to us. They have three sexes, they have intersex type stuff, they speak very different, they have very different meanings within words. And then, of course, you have to get over the initial distrust and find ways to connect with them. And of course, the learning that comes out of her scenario is that we have to embrace these things and absorb them, take them on, move forward. I mean, it's a long way from Lego Serious Play, or is it? Because Lego Serious Play is one of the things I really know you for and admire that work that you've done and how you've taken this modular approach and constructively provided opportunities for people to think through doing and understanding the mind, the relationship with the hand, and that physicality of ideas thinking. It is a form of machine code, isn't it? And I love when you talk about the machine code of all these different languages, whether it's narrow AI or generative or so on. Where's Lego Serious Play and constructive building of ideas in all of this, Johan?
I think it's about, it's a tool to help some of these core human skills. Mm. There are evergreens and ever more important in our society. When my colleague at IMD once upon a time, many years ago, Bart Victor and I started to work on this, it was about getting people to see the world a little bit differently, see the same in a different way, and see entirely new things. And with see, I mean also create entirely new things. So this is the beauty of materials and working with materials. And there are many materials in the world that you can work with. So ultimately, it's not really about the Lego. I hope people at Lego will forgive me to say this, but it's not really about the Lego, but it's about the constructivism and constructionism. It's just that the Lego materials are so fantastically good because of the clutching power and the stuff that it works very well. But soft stuff is also good. But so it is something very basic about creating, constructing, deconstructing, reconstructing, about communicating through objects, object-mediated communication. It is also about, which I call it, confrontation in a positive way. To argue over something is difficult when you look people in the face or in the eyes, right? And I disagree with you, Gareth. It's much easier to hold up a thing and say, no, Gareth, it should be this way.
Yeah.
So it's a different way. And it actually has really foundational stuff in it, as you know. It's we built it on not just on the theories underlying the whole Lego system of constructionism and constructivism, Piaget and Papert stuff, but also I was a student of complex adaptive system theories in the 90s, and I was absolutely fascinated by the notion of adaptive system, using it as a metaphor. This, of course, sort of a science theory, and I was at the Santa Fe Institute and all that. That there was so much happening there. But as a metaphor for social system, I think it has quite valuable insights. And we built that into the idea that, for example, you always start with identity. The whole notion of also from the two of these neuroscientists from Chile, Umberto Maturana and Francesco Varela, also very influential in my thinking. This notion of what you see depends on who you are. So you better start with who you are rather than just looking outside. So this notion of you understand yourself, and it turns out that also play, when you play, you actually bring yourself into it. So identity is also part of play, and you often change your identity through play a little bit. So there's a bunch of stuff that's built into this, and the notion of connection, the notion of emergent behavior, the notion of simple guiding principles that was part of our original applications. I think it's an evergreen, but I've developed some new products recently.
I was going to say, if our listeners aren't familiar with the Lego Serious Play, I think everyone's familiar with Lego, but maybe you could just do a quick 30 seconds on, you know, what is Lego Serious Play, and maybe a second bit, which I'm curious about. Was this a childhood love of Lego and your passion at work, and you decided you'd connect the two together?
Okay, Lego Serious Play is since 10 years, an open source method that is used by typically educators and consultants worldwide, thousands, if not tens of thousands of them, using it as a facilitated and playful process in a serious context, and using Lego materials as a language to actually look at anything from teamwork to organizational work to strategy, whatever. It has sort of a organizational background. That's how we developed it in the beginning. For many years, Lego did this inside, and then they said, we can't cope it, we're doing it, letting it loose. So there's a bunch of, what should we call it, facilitators, and it's a little bit the Wild West over it, but, you know, facilitators who then can train other facilitators immediately. And so on. But there's thousands of people using it. It's probably the most impactful thing I've ever been part of doing. So it's super, super interesting, and lots of great facilitators out there in the world using this particular tool. You should use it as a facilitated tool, because otherwise it can be very intimidating, but you can buy the stuff on the Lego web shop.
And was it your boyhood love of Lego that got you into it?
I think it was two things. I am sort of, I must say, since boyhood, I wish I would have saved some of those. I wouldn't have opened the sets and saved them, because they are, you know, hardcore values now. But I am, of course, a Lego boy as well. But it came actually from, I was professor at IMD in Switzerland at the time, and I started to work with the Lego company. And I have a paper on this if anyone is interested in it. It's referenced, well, from 2004. But the whole idea was that I saw that managers of this playful company, they were very serious, and they didn't use the stuff. They just doodled with it. So at one point in time, I suggested, also with my colleague Bart, couldn't you come back with a solution to a case study, for instance, or a discussion, and build something? And we talk about it. And that was a long process of several years, where we started to use anything from white Lego as a canvas to pre-built models of, you know, pirate ships or whatever. And we experimented for several years before Lego commercialized it. And we did this, and it was super interesting to see how it changed the dynamics when we changed a mode of working, or we should call it mode of intentionality, to be philosophical, from work to a little bit more play, and from changing the mode, medium of communication from 2D or flatland, as Edward Tufte would call it, to 3D. Those two radical changes just changed the whole dynamics and how people started to think about it. And we could say, wow, there's something here. And then we worked with Lego to develop it. And then they pulled in some designers and administrators to do it.
Fantastic.
It's incredible. It's had a huge impact, I think, on business organizational thinking, and also our understanding of, you know, imagination and bringing our whole selves into the thinking process, getting away from, as you say, the 2D flatland, and getting into three-dimensional thinking and collaborating with each other. Now, I always remember the first time, I think I was at the London School of Economics, when they brought out, and you were there possibly, in the box space. In fact, I think you definitely were, although I'm thinking back now. In the box space where they brought out the Lego, and we started to deal with quite big questions using Lego and how it transformed our thinking at the time. It was, you know, it always stays with me. And I think it stays with most people when they have those experiences. It's that face-to-face thing and that building together. And as you say, you can be, it's easy to be harder on the models that you build together than it is rather than going head-to-head and against each other's, you know, ideas about things. Much easier to be harder on the models. I have my concern, and it'd be interesting, what do you think, now that we're in the digital world and there's so much work going on over digital communication networks and those channels, that we then, we're back out of the three dimensions again. Do you have a view on how we build construction back into being digital and how we can bring those things to that kind of thinking to life in the digital?
Well, it's a little bit like meetings, right? We went from face-to-face meetings, too many of them, into online meetings during COVID, right? And we felt like, this is a little bit uncomfortable. And then we started to be more and more skilled at them. And then we started to see like, whoa, Zoom and whatever have some fantastic features. And it turns out that it's pretty effective, could be pretty effective.
Yeah.
But then we started to realize like, well, what about the new people being on? We just see them in flatland, right? And like this, and we see their upper heart, and we don't know how they look like, you know, and how they smell like and how they feel like. So it turns out, of course, that we have to strike a balance. You know, if we know each other, we can do this for a while, but it was good to meet every now and then. So it's this notion of, when does it make sense to meet face to face? And then not just sit in a room with a laptop in front of each other.
Yeah.
I think it's up to everyone to just see what makes sense for them. I do think there is a need for this. And I think it's smart to use the precious face-to-face time and not just do face-to-face, but maybe hands-to-hands as well. So there's something to using this. Otherwise, we're getting poorer in a sense. It's like we can be efficient this way. I think we can be efficient, we can be effective, but could we also be, maybe we need a little bit of hands-on together to be even more effective, and I'll do it this way, imaginative. To be more imaginative and perhaps even more responsible, and then also effective when we meet in person. So I don't have any wonder medicine for this, but I do think we just have to find a way. And, you know, tools like using Lego Series Play, there's zillions of other tools as well. I think they have a place, but these are not tools you use when you're stressed and hypered up and have to deliver tomorrow. I always it's back to Amy Edmondson's concept of psychological safety and all that. We need to have a safe and secure space. In a paper I did later on after this, my colleague Matt Statler and I at that time, we talked about not just a mode of thinking about it, and not just the medium of communication, but also the importance of the milieu, you know, the immediate environment where you are, that it matters a lot. You know, we try things out in boring, sterile rooms and in very amazing stuff, and it changes the context, as you yourself say, matters a lot also to these things. So let's strike a balance.
So building on the immediate environment to another theme that I know you have some views on, so the in-between. So it sounds like it could be something from a Stranger Things episode or a Netflix series, but tell us about the in-between and your thoughts on the in-between.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've just been asked to give a presentation for a big foundation on this topic, and I haven't figured it out yet, so it's a few weeks down the line. But it's the whole notion that things just don't happen when everything is homogenous, you know, in one strata. And things happen in between. And you can start to add words. It happens in between people. I often say that idea, I cannot say that the idea emerged in my mind. It emerged in between my mind and other people, right? So it's this notion of it emerged in between people. It emerged between social system of different kinds, between groups, right? It emerges between cultures. You know, you can say in between could be just for the good and for the bad. You know, it's friction happens in between. Just look at, I know it doesn't exist in the UK, social classes. But, you know, look at there's no innovation within any of these classes. The innovation is in between.
Yes.
Boundary span. It's sort of in between the friction and excitement in between and the movement in between. That's where action happens. It is in between on a society. It's in between the university sector, the governmental sector, the state sector, and the business sector where things happen. This is the famous triple helix. It's not in one of them. It's when people come together. That's where it happens. So it's this notion of cherishing the in-betweenness, whatever we should call it, of almost staging it, of cultivating it. I think that's where we can do much more. That's why we put project groups together and we bring people in. That's at Hult, for instance, we have students from 143 nationalities right now, I think. And we bring, it's incredible. You have from every religion, from every color, whatever you want to have, every culture, whatever. And we design groups for 6 weeks when they come, and we maximize diversity. Very frustrating and very rewarding. Right. Very frustrating. And you can imagine all of these different cultures working it out, perspective, backgrounds, everything. They just have to work it out. And we cultivate that. But after 6 weeks, they are so much more ready to meet the world.
So it's essentially the concept of the greater the diversity, the in-between two different things. And I guess it has to be two different elements there, is my assumption in what you're saying, that if things are the same on both sides, you don't get that creativity. But it's between two bodies, two things, two different people, two different concepts. This is the bringing them together, the in-between piece that creates the magic.
And it is, to some extent, idealistic. You know, it's an idealistic view of a thing. Because it's really difficult and it's really annoying sometimes. And it's really, people can get angry at each other, right? And it's in that friction. It's the friction in between, I think, is the source for hopefully curiosity, but also imagination. Take away that's the positive side, that's the bright side. But there is this other dark side that sometimes people want to kill each other when they're, you know.
But is that you kill the other, you people, when you don't know how to deal with the shadow and you try and kill it before you understand it?
Yeah, it's we against them. And, you know, look at the world and you'll find, if you haven't read it yet, you should read the book by Joseph Heinrich on the weirdest people of the world, right? The weird being the Western educated, industrial, the democratic and rich part of the world. That's an anomaly. The rest of the world is clan based.
Yes.
You know, and then it's we against them. And it's like which family clan should dominate and all that. Mm. But those systems are not scalable on a society level. He's a wonderful expose of how did the Western world sort of scale with systems up here. And that seems to function reasonably well, not, as we know, perfect in any way. But it's a beautiful way to say, like, well, it's like, how do you get people to, it's another related topic, but how do you get people to feel being the same, or millions of people being the same English or British or American or Chinese or something. It's an imagined community, right?
Mm.
You don't meet them. You meet a lot of other people you don't meet, but still you feel waving the flag, right? How do you do that? And it's sort of, it's a balance between that and sort of exposing it to friction at various levels of scale.
Mm.
A big friction we see in Ukraine now, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Very bad, not nice of the Russians to attack Ukraine, but like there's friction there, but there's also this positive side, I said, when you look at it from another perspective at various levels, from the individual group society level to nation level.
So it reminds me of the Leonard Cohen song where he talks about where the cracks are in, that's where the light gets in. And it's the point where the cracks are and the point where the differences are, that's where we learn the most.
It's a good one, because also Leonard Cohen, if you think of it, when he said, I was sentenced to 20 years of boredom, right? Before something happened,
yeah. Right?
20 years of boredom for trying to change the system from within, right? That's the beginning of first we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin. But it's a beautiful statement. Like, well, it's difficult to change the system from within for all kinds of reasons, because identity is very strong in all systems and it's a survival mechanism. Mm. If identity of a system isn't strong, it will break down. So you have to have all of these defense routines. But that's the notion of exposing yourself to a little bit uncomfort is about letting some signals come in. So you're simultaneously closed for your mental health and for the national security, but you're also open to new signals. This is, I think, very important job of education. And I'm proud to say that in HALT, which is such an international school, I think we balance that pretty well.
Fantastic.
What are you personally curious about, Johan? And I guess, how would you define curiosity in your mind? What are you personally curious about at the moment?
A lot. I see it as a hunger. You know, I'm hungry. The moment you're not, so I'm starving for new stuff. I love, you know, I shouldn't say this, but I do love to expose myself for new ideas. I've been called many things, negative things in my life, but I've never been called neither a coward nor not being curious. So it's the notion of just go out and put yourself in danger a little bit. You know, what do you call it? Walking on the wild side, right? Not really, on the edge of the wild side. Lou Reed.
Too far into it.
Absolutely, on the wild side.
But just on the boundary, on the border of wild side, just on the edge of what is okay. I think that's the most exciting part. That is where you can see new things. You can, and that, the more curious you are, I think, the more you go towards the edge.
So maybe building on your curiosity, so as we're coming towards the end of our time, one of the things we like to do is ask if there's any questions that you have of us. So having asked you a lot of questions over the past time, anything you'd like to ask of us?
I'm thinking about your book is great. I sort of just skimmed it, but I like your all the dimensions of curiosity, divergent, inquisitive, and all that. But like also on your diagnostics for these 7 C's.
Mm.
When yes. You, I don't know how much data you have on that, but it would be interesting to see if there is any kind of dominant facets of that or dominant dimensions in various situations. And what does that mean in a sense? Then we can talk about what to do about it. But what's dominating in your frameworks when you go out and talk to people and gather data about it?
Yeah, so one of the things that working with some of your colleagues at HALT around is an enterprise diagnostic for curiosity, and that will look at the 7 dimensions, and in there it's already building up a very interesting data set around where different organizations are strong in certain areas and weaker in others. And at the heart of that, we have our curiosity engine, which is around creativity and construction, which construction being one we've talked a lot on this episode around. But the data is super interesting there around, you know, where do organizations major, if you like, on the creativity side? So, you know, great at ideas, but then maybe not so strong on the construction idea of actually seeing those ideas through. or the other way around, that maybe too quick on the construction and not enough time in the creativity piece. So jump on the first idea, race to action, and go through the construction piece. So as we get more data through this, it's going to be fascinating to watch those two dimensions and the sort of interplay between, you know, what's the optimum creativity versus construction, too much of one, maybe overplaying it, not enough of one, maybe an issue as well. So those two, I think, are ones where the data is giving us some really interesting facts.
Okay. So what is the sort of the most meaningful unit level of analysis for curiosity in your mind? Is it sort of ultimately an individual thing, or is it a social thing?
There's a lot of work on curiosity and the individuals and the psychological dimensions of curiosity for the individual. And that's a sort of well-trod path. Where it's becoming more interesting is when we understand the neuroscience behind that and how that relates to behaviorism at the individual level. But for us personally, we think it's useful to have a look at the organization and the team, because not much work has been done on the curiosity and collaboration, or curiosity of an organization. And it's difficult to say, how do you create a culture of curiosity? Because we know that a culture is so many dimensions that have to be in place. But we do think that things such as, you mentioned, you know, psychological safety, the way that we as leaders behave, especially in the digital realm, the kinds of questions that we're asking of our teams, and how we enable teams to be curious. And then that leads, of course, to confidence. How do we as leaders enable confidence within the organization so that people feel free to go beyond? And as you talk about, you know, that need to be on the edge for imagination, and that need to learn on the edge. And you have to feel safe to be able to go to the edge. And you also have to feel safe that you can fail and come back, that you're not going to die. And how do you as a leader in this new digital reality create teams who are confident enough to be at the edge and to explore and to feel safe? And for us, that's a very interesting place. So that, how can you create curious organizations which are also understanding the relationship between boundaries and being on the edge, and how open to be? Is it how to be not completely open, because that's destabilizing? How to be open enough to be creative? So those are the kind of dimensions we're exploring at our levels when we're talking about curiosity.
Can you be too curious?
I think we can be too curious.
You can get lost in your curiosity. So if you don't structure your curiosity, then if you have children, if they're anything like mine, if you leave them on a device for too long without any structure, then they'll follow the path of curiosity, but it will take you through aimless YouTube videos and whatever, and may or may not be all that productive. And that was a little bit behind coming up with the 7 C's in the first place, was to provide and structure to that curiosity.
You know, that idea that just being, you know, surfing, you know, going after pleasure constantly. We talk about critical thinking is important, so that you're not just following desire, but you're also stopping and stepping back and going, you know, what are my biases here? And having those filters really helps with curiosity. And of course, then construction, which brings us right back to the work that you've done. You know, got a bunch of ideas and they're open, start building something, because then the framework is built at the same time as the content, and that's it's unique. And all things become constrained in time. So how do you manage those things?
We're coming up to our time now. Rich conversation. So going from how the education system is changing and moving towards sort of more skills development versus knowledge, and the speed that that skills are changing, the value maybe of power skills or softer skills in terms of having a longer life, how you're focusing on learning how to learn as one of those critical skills, and bringing in things like life coaches into to education as well. Took a quick foray through ChatGPT and the role of AI and how that's developed over the last few years off the back of some of the changes that we saw with the pandemic as well. Discovered that your favorite sci-fi is Arthur C. Clarke, and how the changing from one variable and looking into the future now is changing to millions of variables, and how generative AI and neural networks are taking us forward. then looked at some of the skills that may be useful. We went into your Lego Serious Play experience and how that came about, what's involved in that, and the value of actually getting our hands on things and being able to build things and put in that constructivist element. We heard around your own personal curiosity and how that's tied to courage as well, and then had a little delve into the in-between and how we see the friction between two different things and the value of diversity that it's in that space in between where things happen. Loads that we covered, Johan. If there was one takeaway that you could leave our listeners with from all of that, or sort of some words of wisdom, what would be your one takeaway?
That's a tricky one. I'll do one on wisdom, since you mentioned the word, and that I think there are shortcuts to gaining wisdom, and you don't have to start looking weight until you look like Dumbledore or a female version of that. it is. There are ways of doing it. And some of the ancient Greeks actually talked about this. And the whole idea is like, how do you practice your moral judgment? Because ultimately it's about that. And because when you're faced with uncertainty, and the plan doesn't work, what are you left with? Well, you're left with your own personal thinking about what's right and wrong, good and bad, sometimes beautiful and not. And how do you practice that? And you practice it through group sports and drama. And sometimes through also constructing stuff with others.
Brilliant.
Because that is very helpful. And that was actually part of this, is the foundation for the classical education of knowing the laws of nature, natural science, understanding how to be smart and street smart, which is a lot of the social sciences, to understanding, you know, to be able to make decisions that are not just good for you, but also for the community that sustains you. And this you practice through moral judgment. That's why you had sport, you had education, natural science, social science, humanities, drama. All of that was the foundation of a good education, because it would help you to be a wiser person.
So focus on our moral judgment and build out that moral judgment.
Practice it where it's safe.
Fantastic. Thank you, Johan. That's been a great conversation.
Thank you, Johan.
Been a real pleasure to have you on. And yeah, a big thank you from both of us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you, boys.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel saying why this was so. And what have we learned from it? We always appreciate hearing your thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today, hashtag Curious Advantage. The Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your physical, digital, or audio book now to further explore the 7 C's model for being more curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast.
The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon.
Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.